Welcome. Please accept John and Jim's invitation to join them as they once again ask each other, what do you think about? Hey, Jim, what do you think about knights?
Are you talking the romantic starlet variety or the ironclad knigets? I'm cool with either one. As far as the tin can knights go, as a kid, my brother and I had the Mark's Sir Gordon, the Golden Knight action figure.
Awesome.
Hell yeah, they were.
Awesome. Those were the best. And I had the Western ones too.
Oh, yeah, the Johnny West and that. Yeah, Dave had all those. And we had their horses and the whole barding for the horses, you know. And my cousins had the Silver Knight. I think
I have no idea what those things cost, but they were fabulous.
Yeah, they were cool. Like G.I. Joe, you know.
With actual little, like you could take the armor on and off. And,
Yeah.
Had big giant swords. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. Full set of armor. And then all the accoutrement that you could have as a knight. Sword, a pike, a harquebus, and all that kind of shit. They were awesome, man.
Yeah, they were.
The one thing. And the Kung Fu Grip G.I. Joes also suffered this malady. Their rubbery fingers tended to crack and break off.
Yeah, after a while.
Over years of play. So they looked like ironclad lepers.
You know? yeah, they did.
Yeah. And my brother also got the Mark's Fighting Knights action playset that came folded up like a suitcase.
Oh, I
was filled
that.
With knights and Vikings and equipment for both camps. And you unfolded it, and when it was unfolded, it became a cat. When it was unfolded, it became a castle. And I tell you what, man, I'd give my left nut to go back to those days.
Oh, I had that circled in the Sears and Roebuck catalog many times.
Yeah,
and Santa never saw clear to send that one.
Yeah, he got that. I got the Cape Canaveral playset. Which was
I did too. It was the rocket and all the little dudes, little astronauts, like soldier men, like army men. I had that one too. I think I got it the same year, as a matter of fact. Yeah. But anyway, I've always loved the Knigets, right? Since I was a kid, man. Who doesn't love the idea of walking around in a suit of armor, impervious to all harm? And you know, speaking of childhood things, did you ever see Bedknobs and Broomsticks? Man, I loved that movie. Well, I mean, as an adult, it's not so great, but I like the parts of the movie where the suits of armor all get up and they go to war against the Germans. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
It's completely dumb, but I liked it all the same.
Yeah. I saw that way back when. I remember going to the theater and seeing it. But we would have been like first or second grade, I think.
Very impressionable age, right?
Yeah. But I remember liking it as a kid. I haven't seen it in who knows how long, so I don't know what I'd think of it. I don't know what I'd think of it today, you know.
That's why you get Disney Plus, man.
Exactly. It was based on a series of children's novels. Never read them, though. Don't know how good they were either.
I didn't actually know that, so yeah, maybe I'll have to read one of those and see if it's worth picking up, because I know it's dumb, but I loved all the Tom Swift and his amazing whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Those were all great. And I think they were making a Tom Swift TV series.
Really?
Did you? Yeah.
Recently?
Like on Netflix or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to look. I hadn't heard that. Hey, by the way, do you know why the medieval times are called the Dark Ages?
No.
Because there were so many knights.
Wait.
Why do dragons sleep during the day?
Obviously, I don't know why.
Because they fight knights.
Okay.
No, seriously though. You had to put in a lot of studying to become a knight. And they had special colleges they had to go to do so.
Really?
They were called night schools.
Oh yeah. Thanks, Henny Lungman. Are we done yet?
Take my wife, please.
Oh, please take my wife. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was, again, as I've gotten to be an adult, this has just merged a whole bunch of shit that I love, right? Is the Knights Templar, right? Have you ever heard of them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, they got a lot going for them that makes them a particularly interesting thing, right? First, they were Knigets in shining armor, like we've talked about. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Secondly, they were a military organization that reported directly to the Pope, not to a king, to the Pope. That's kind of good. I mean, you know, maybe if you're the Pope, you got a standing army.
Yeah, that's a little questionable.
That's pretty excellent, right? And then lastly, they were based in Jerusalem, not in Europe. They were based in the Holy Land. And, you know, lots of people credit them with creating the modern banking system. So that's kind of weird, too, when you think that it's a private army that the Pope had that invented banks.
Yeah, they were pretty cool. I don't know all that much about them. I mean, I've got a superficial knowledge from reading like World Book Encyclopedia and seeing this horrible History Channel, you know, documentaries.
Where they repeat the same information 26 times.
Exactly. Yeah. And, but yeah, I don't know how much I've retained. So we'll find out as we go through this. I don't think they were all out there fighting the Muslims, though, were they? I mean, they went to the Holy Land for the Crusades, but didn't a lot of them have like nine to five jobs as like moneylenders and fundraisers and all that kind of shit?
Well, probably, but you know, the most fun part though, for me anyway, and what really turned me onto the Knights Templar was Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? That whole Indiana Jones series of movies, and then we get to the second one with Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail, quest for the Holy Grail. What the hell is that one called?
That was the third one. The second one was the Temple of Dumb.
Where Indy's dad dies, right? That's the third one.
That's the third one.
Okay, so it's Indiana Jones and the
Last Crusade, I think.
And the Last Crusade, yeah. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. But at the end there, that's a Knights Templar knight that's in the room with all the chalices.
Yeah.
And he must be 1,000 years old. Right. And so at the end of the thing there, that's a Knights Templar. That's one of the Knights Templar that's in the room with Indy and his dad who's been shot. And only the Grail of Christ can save his father's life, right? Earlier in the movie, we see some dude run over, grab the Grail, and he chugs out of it, and he meets a horrific doom, right? He dies because basically he didn't pick the right cup, and there's like 80 of them.
He did not choose wisely.
That's exactly what he said.
I'm starting to remember it. All right,
so then Indy looks around and finds a wooden cup and slaps some water in it and pours it on his dad's wounds, and they all heal. Yay. Because Indy figured out that Christ wouldn't have had a big fancy jeweled cup. It would have been a little poorer. And, but that was really just stuck in there because they needed, the Knights Templar have always been associated with the Holy Grail, right? And lots of people seem to think that the Knights had access to the Holy Grail because they found it in Jerusalem and all these other sorts of things. But there's tons of books, and I'm not sure exactly. One of them claimed to be pretty scholarly, but I'm not really sure that this guy really knows how to do scholarly. But it's called
A Scholarly Guide to the Holy Grail. No, seriously, this is scholarly.
Is that the one? No, that's not the one. That's not the one. It's The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, that's the name of the book, is The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. And it basically claims that the Grail wound up in Scotland. And that's a whole story in and of itself there at the end. But so we got the Knights Templar getting away with the Holy Grail. We've got the Knights Templar getting away with the Shroud of Turin. That's how the Pope gets his hand on that, is because the Knights bring it to him. You get the Knights Templar getting away with the Piece of the Run True Cross, We've got the Knights Templar getting away with huge, vast sums of treasure. And this is all fun to me. You know, I think they're an excellent foil, a bad guy for modern audiences, or something weird that they can use. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
As it, you know, you can't use Nazis for everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Nazis are a good bad guy. You know, the Mafia is a good bad guy. Nobody really complains about when you use those things. But the Knights Templar are a good bad guy for conspiracy theory type stuff. Yeah,
there's a shroud of mystery.
Yeah, exactly. Because as we'll see through this whole thing, I'm going to try and go through this podcast and try and separate what we know for a fact from what the legend was. So it's going to read a bit like a little bit of a history lesson, but stick with me. It's for a reason. Okay, so you ready, Jimmy?
Ready.
We need a bit of history to describe why the order was even founded. And I think, too, it's important to disclaim history, because history as a concept is inherently biased, right? This discussion is going to sound like it's a very much a good versus evil kind of thing. But I want to make it plain that I don't share that view. Islam is a great religion. It's got a long, deep history and tradition. And like Christianity, we both share roots back to Judaism and the Abrahamic traditions.
I mean, it's one of the Abrahamic religions along with Judaism and Christianity. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not a bus toss of Islam. This is more of an examination of the world at the time of the Crusades, not trying to justify any of that stuff, but just this is the world they lived in. But since this is about the Knights Templar, it's kind of going to be from the Christian point of view, because that's the history we're discussing, right? Like, I mean, they report the Pope, their religious order, all the,
right.
You know, so it's all going to be kind of from that Christian perspective. I'm not advocating anything that they did or defending it. But it's extremely naive to reduce wars to good versus evil. There's always good people that die on either side. So the Holy Lands, meaning all of Jerusalem and the area around there, which is what, you know, nowadays Israel, Palestine, Syria, those kind of places are what we consider broadly the Holy Lands. And they had been under Muslim rule for about 400 years, right? So we're right around the year 1000, because Islam was founded in like 660. And generally there was no problem, right? The Christians that lived in the area had lived in the area under Islamic rule, and pilgrims from Europe were able to visit and things without too much trouble. But around the year 1073, a different group of Muslims took over and control of Jerusalem transferred to the Sayyid dynasty. And they weren't really all that friendly to Christians as the previous rulers had been. And so they were blocking access to Jerusalem. They were blocking access to the Holy Lands. This group of Muslims came out of this leadership and government came out of Egypt and moved over that way. So this all came to a head and resulted in a war that then became known as the First Crusade. The First Crusade was a victory by the Europeans. And when they won, they established several Christian kingdoms. And altogether, these were called the Levant. And I want to point out that one of those kingdoms was called the Kingdom of Jerusalem, but it was really Jerusalem and all its surrounding lands.
So what was it, the city of Jerusalem, the capital of this kingdom of Jerusalem you mentioned?
Yeah, it was, until it wasn't. But yes, depending on when you look and which crusades had just been fought and who won and who lost and all these other sorts of things, then the capital was either Jerusalem or a city called Acre. I like the name Acre for a city, by the way. I think most people are familiar with the Crusades as a concept, right? Because History Channel and all these, you know, popular culture sorts of things around it. But they were really a series of ongoing wars and battles between Christian and Muslim forces over not only the control of the Holy Land, but also the Basque forces in Spain and all these things. Because prior to the year 1100 or so, in that 400-year period run up between, say, 660 when Islam is founded and the start of the First Crusades around, you know, late thousands, the Muslim Empire extended all across Southern Europe Northern Africa. And so they were in Portugal, they were in Spain, they were in all of Northern Africa, parts of Greece and Turkey. I mean, the whole thing was all just Muslim. And some of the Crusades were fought about those things too. Everybody tends to focus, though, on the Crusades that were fought over the Holy Land.
Right, yeah.
There's a total of 9 Crusades. I mean, one of them went to Spain, but people think of the ones that go to the Holy Land. But these wars went back and forth for centuries, with control of Jerusalem changing based on who won the most recent battle. So if I won, I have control. And if you won, you had control. Because that was really what they were fighting over. Here's the shitty part, right? Is when control of Jerusalem changed, you know, the Muslims would slaughter the Christians. And then when the Christians would gain control of Jerusalem, they'd slaughter the Muslims. I mean, it was just, you know, slaughter being an equal opportunity employer. But in any case, in the Middle Ages, there were tons of European Christians that wanted to make pilgrimages to the Holy Land, you know, for whatever reason. These pilgrims, though, were often robbed or attacked while they were in the more wild areas, say, between Italy and Jerusalem, right? So they're going to walk from Italy, because that's how you got places, to Jerusalem, which is doable, but not exactly safe. Sometimes they were robbed. Sometimes they got killed. But a knight named Hugh de Payn, who's a French guy, so he's Hugh de Payn, who had not, he didn't go back to Europe after the First Crusade. He hung out in Jerusalem. And he thought the problem of protecting the pilgrims could be solved by the formation of a military body whose charter would be to protect these pilgrims. And, you know, all by itself, I mean, that seems like a fine idea. Around 1118 of the Christian era, he manages to convince Baldwin II, who's the king of Jerusalem at the time, that this was needed, and they received quarters on Temple Mount, which is a big deal.
Yeah, Temple Mount was and is a big deal for Christians, Jews, and Muslims.
Yeah.
It was the location of the original Temple of Solomon, as well as the second Temple of Solomon, and the third temple that will be constructed when the Messiah returns is also going to be built there, I think.
Yep.
And the only part still standing is the Wailing Wall, if I'm correct.
Yeah, maybe. It depends on how you look at things. Like, parts of the temple walls still remain, even where the Wailing Wall, it kind of goes around there. Islamic tradition, though, this is the best part of the whole thing, is Islam has that the Western Wall is the spot where the Prophet Muhammad tethered his flying horse prior to his ascension into heaven.
Why bother? I mean, just ride the flying horse up to paradise rather than walking, man.
Well, you know, you got to tether it so everybody can have a talk and you have some lunch. You got to do your thing, you know. Not only that, I mean, so it's, this area is revered for that too. As far as Temple Mount is concerned, it's the location of both the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Dome of the Rock is a Muslim shrine that was kind of erected over, well, I mean, it's a big rock, okay? But this rock is believed by Jews to be the spot where God created Adam. And tradition holds that this mosque was the foundation of the Holy of Holies that you hear referred to in the Old Testament, Temple of Solomon.
Mm-hmm. Inside the tabernacle.
Yeah.
In the tabernacle. Yeah. Yeah.
So this was the stone that was that foundation, right? In Islamic tradition, this rock was the spot where Muhammad began his night journey, which was one of the miracles in Islam, in which he traveled from Mecca, which is over in Saudi Arabia, to the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the back of his winged steed, led prophets in prayer as it, you know, he gets there. Then he leads everybody in prayer. Then he goes up to heaven where he speaks to Allah, and Allah gives him instructions on the proper way to pray. And then Muhammad has to return to earth to teach people the proper way to pray. It occurs to me that if I wanted to teach a class called How to Piss Off People for All Eternity, you could basically cover the history of Jerusalem and specifically Temple Mount.
That or piss on them. That really pisses people off. Or is it on?
Anyway, as far as the Knights Templar are concerned, they were given an office in the royal palace that stood on top of Temple Mount. What, you don't remember me mentioning of the palace there? Of course you do. Because after the war, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was converted from a mosque, the third holiest site in all of Islam, mind you, into the king's palace. Ugh. So King Baldwin, he just marches in and changes it from a mosque to I'm living now here in this thing because it's beautiful. I mean, I'm sorry, but like I said, pissing people off. So anyway, the knights were headquartered here, and this is where they took their name, the Poor Knights of Christ and the Temple of Solomon.
Yeah, I think it was even longer than that. The Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. Poor? What chutzpah! They were as rich as Croesus. These bastards basically invented the model of modern banking, you said.
Yeah, well, they were poor. I mean, you know, at least in the beginning. The newly found order was broke, consisted of 8 or 9 knights. They depended on donations. Their official emblem was one of 2 knights riding a single horse to emphasize their poverty, because they really did not have more than 3 horses. And you got 9 knights, so you got to buddy up. The Poor Knights of Christ and Temple of Solomon was the reason they became known as Templars, right? So at the time, a Templar was a person who lived in a temple. But nowadays, I think that word Templar is synonymous with the Knights Templar.
I guess that makes me a Hausler. But how did these paupers become legendary for banking and wealth?
Well, one of their members, the original 8 members, was a knight named André de Montbach. And he was the uncle of a powerful French abbot, a guy who eventually becomes known as Saint Bernard.
Oh, yeah, Saint Bernard. They loved to take him with them on their ski outings. And he always wore this tiny little keg of brandy around his neck. His kisses were really slobbery, though. It was kind of gross.
I know. Yours are really slobbery, too.
Yeah. If you're lucky.
Yeah, you're a little moist, brother. But Saint Bernard, who was that guy in religious order, worked with Hugh de Payne, and they came up with a code of conduct for the order. Back in these days, you know, there were monasteries all over the place and stuff, and they pretty much based it on that. And this has become known as the, quote, Latin rule, and it originally had 72 rules in it. And these detailed every aspect of life for a member of an order. Clothing, appearance, and day-to-day life was covered by these rules. For the Knights Templar, though, these were basically a mix of the rules used by the Benedictine monks and the rules needed to support a fighting force. Some of the rules, for example, were things like no more than 3 meals a week could have meat in them, or 0 interaction with any females, fasting and prayer intervals. And over time, it expanded to around 600 rules, which included organizational structure, how much wealth an individual could have, which was basically counted in servants and horses, and what happened to this wealth when that person died. Anyway, St. Bernard strongly supported the mission of the knights, and he wrote a document called In Praise of the New Knighthood. Now, it's called the New Knighthood because the knights that they had had prior to this moment were all aristocratic dicks, right? They would abuse their power, and they were rich, and, you know, they're wearing a suit of armor, so what are you going to do to stop them? So it's the new knighthood, which makes them saintly. And you'll see later that this treatise had a huge influence on how the Knights Templar actually operated. But for now, we just need to understand that he supported the formation of this order. And so in 1129, at the Council of Troyes, he got official recognition of the order approved from this council. And that's really all they needed. You know, now it's kind of rubber stamped by the Pope at that point. But once the Knights Templar were an official religious order recognized by the Pope, Hugh de Payne, the guy we talked about who had founded the whole thing, became the Grand Master, or the head of the order. And now he needs to go on a European tour to visit all of the secular leaders in Europe begging for money. And he must have been a good fundraiser because his visit to King Henry I is documented in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It records that in 1128, Henry I donated money, not only from Normandy, but also in England. So while not explicitly stated, it's believed that these gifts of wealth included the states. Hugh continues his tour, and he goes onward to Scotland and Spain and Italy and the Holy Roman Empire. And in the matter of a few years, the order now had estates and land all over Europe. Now, before people start thinking this is kind of weird, this is all how things worked then. This is pretty standard. It's how monasteries were formed and funded. But little thought of its implications were given when they were putting together the rules for the operation of the order. The rules were basically lifted directly from the way monasteries of the day operated. For instance, the order had rules around charity to the poor. So 1/10 of all your bread that they produced, for example, was distributed to the needy as alms. They had rules about when they slept, when they worked, what they wore. As a, you ever look on the internet nowadays, you'll find a meme that points out that the Templars were forbidden to wear, quote, pointy shoes or shoes with laces. And the reason for that is at this time, these items were expensive and it was considered a display of wealth to wear those things.
Man, living in a monastery sounds like being in a military organization itself. What with the rules telling you what to wear and when to work. And as far as the shoes go, since they couldn't have laces, what'd they wear? Penny loafers? On second thought, that shiny penny might have been construed as a display of wealth.
Yeah, might have. But, you know, not all boots have to be pointy. Common peasants wore the non-pointy boot. So that's what they wore. So these rules are nominally similar, right? I mean, that's what they based the order on. But monasteries, unlike armies, are far cheaper to operate than a whole army of knights. The knights' horses, equipment, support staff, along with food and lodging and logistics, these were very expensive, and it forced the order to manage money in ways that were not before thought of. So what people don't really realize is that when people ran off to join the Knights Templar, because they were kind of celebrities of the day, man, they were like the Rolling Stones, you know, they were a big deal. But a lot of people that joined weren't combatants. They were going to be in the support organizations. I mean, you know, like the U.S. Army has literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people devoted simply to getting from point A to point B, right? I mean, that's their only job, is to make sure the gear gets there or troops get fed. So the non-combatant members of the order, which were 90% of them, they built a large financial network across most of Christendom. And the order had over 1,000 commanderies, which is basically the military equivalent of a monastery, throughout Europe and the Holy Land. Because they didn't really report to anybody other than the Pope, this is arguably the first example of a multinational corporation in history. They worked together as part of the larger order, and each individual person was bound by the rules of the order, which did include a vow of poverty. So as individuals, they really didn't own anything related to this network of buildings. It was all owned and governed by the order from its headquarters in Jerusalem. Now, one of the things the Pope did was he issued a papal bull that said the Knights Templar report to me and only me, and they're not beholden to any local laws, borders, or taxes. So they were free to use the entirety of their resources to expand and support their super expensive knights and their military activities. So while the original Latin rules mentioned how much wealth an individual knight could own and detailed their vows of poverty, it failed to address the wealth of the order itself. And in fact, St. Bernard included a phrase that said, material poverty would threaten spiritual wealth.
Yeah.
Because he recognized that they need money in order to run an army. So they were well aware of the fact that the order had an important role to play, the protection of pilgrims on pilgrimages to the Holy Land. And this does require some amount of wealth in order to operate. Over time, though, this phrase was seen by later Templars as a sort of green light to acquire wealth.
Greedy.
And we'll attempt to do the same thing by mentioning Anchor Podcasting. So Hugh de Payne had accomplished what he had wanted to accomplish. He now had a secure financial base for his order and a steady stream of recruits. Like I said, they were like the Rolling Stones, man. You know, if you were an English nobleman and you had three sons and you didn't know what to do with the third one, throw them off to the Knights Templar, let them join that. It's a prestigious position. And, you know, that way that kid's not hanging around the house anymore. You know, it's all good. But he died in 1136, which was 3 years prior to the papal bull that protected the knights from the local interference. And so he never lived to see the massive wealth and success that the Knights Templar had, or their influence on the world. But with the blessing of the Pope, the Knights Templar became a favored charity. They were given money, land, businesses, noble-born sons to be raised from within the order, from rich families eager to help with the war in the Holy Land. Pope Innocent II officially funded them from the Vatican in 1135, and then in 1139, he issued a papal bull, which is basically a decree, that exempted members of the Knights Templar from any local laws. This meant that they could travel freely, were exempted from any taxes, and answered only to the Pope.
So that's how they became rich. It's a lot easier to acquire wealth when you don't have to pay taxes on it. And then to be immune from any prosecutions by anyone other than the Pope. Man, these cats had it made.
Yeah, and I don't think they really recognized that at first. But as over time, as they're growing, and more of these noble sons are joining the organization in non-combat roles, they begin playing a little fast and loose with what they can get away with, right? But once money and resources became less of an issue, then the order grows quickly. And the order was instrumental in several battles related to the Crusades and were often the first into battle. I mean, nobody questions the fact that the Knights Templar were not excellent knights. They were excellent warriors. And these mounted knights on horseback were the medieval equivalent of today's tanks. And they were highly trained and well-equipped. So one of the other things they had, besides just the knights, in the support organization around them, they had standing armies. They had pikemen, archers, cooks. I mean, they traveled with an army of 15,000 people that they funded. So Rule 49 of the original Latin rules allowed for the order to hold land and landed estates. Initially, these couldn't be bought. They all had to be donated to the order. But if landed royalty wanted to donate to the order, they grant these estates, right? And they get prestige out of it because, remember, at this time, feudalism was in full swing. So the land also included farms and farmers to farm that land. This is kind of goofy, but this allowed the knights to take vassals who would then in turn funnel money into the order's coffers. They did have a small problem though, Jimmy. How do you reconcile being a religious order with also being a military order that's hell-bent on killing people on a regular basis?
Well, you just open up your Bible and you pull out this nugget from Ecclesiastes 3. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to love, a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. And there you got your reasoning.
Yep, and then you get kind of a green light, right? But luckily for the order, their benefactor, St. Bernard, he included some logic in this treatise that supported the creation of the order of the poor knights of Christ in the Temple of Solomon. He also included some text that absolved the order from any sinful connotations of the normal activity of war. You know, looting, pillaging, murdering. He's credited with creating the concept of malicide. That is to say, the killing of evil. Any killing done by the armies of God, and therefore the armies of good, against non-believers, and, you know, therefore evil, was fine. No problem. And also, over the centuries, whenever there was a question about the activities of the Knights Templar, that Pope of the day would issue a papal bull that would address that specific issue related to their activities. So this series of papal bulls gave the ability to collect tithes, burial fees, keep any wealth they obtained by winning battles, you know, also known as pillaging or spoils of war. This all led to the knights not only being well-funded, which honestly was their founder's biggest concern, because, you know, when he looked around the room, there was only seven other guys and three horses, but also to become really wealthy.
And those papal bulls were papal bullshit.
It depends on, you know,
which end you were. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to argue whether or not they should have been doing any of this stuff. because personally it doesn't sound right to me, but it is pretty cool how that, how this all happened. So the question is, though, over time, how do you use all this wealth to advance the mission of the order? I mean, I think the Templars began their business enterprises in a mostly accidental manner, honestly. They were solving the problems they saw, and over time, because 90% of the order's members weren't involved in actual fighting, they came up with some novel solutions. So we've got some money. The Knights begin to issue interest-bearing loans. That's banking, right? But moneylenders is nothing new. You know, the Bible, Jesus throws the moneylenders out of the temple, right?
Right.
You know, so moneylenders isn't anything new, but they started doing that because they had enough assets to do that. And then they started providing transportation services for a fee. Again, I don't think that's a novel idea, but the idea that they could do that was a new idea to them. They sold wine and farm goods that were created on their lands where they had farms. This was all in an effort to supply the money needed to support the mission of the order. And they were considered, too, a very safe place to, quote unquote, deposit any wealth you wanted to keep safe. Keep in mind, you know, they've got these 1,000 commanderies around the place, and they're all got knights at them. So if you were a local and you needed to save your stash of whatever, put it in there and they'll keep an eye on it for you. But at the same time, keep in mind that the way pilgrims got to the Holy Land was a land route, right? Which basically means you're walking from Europe to the Holy Land, and it was dangerous. And as we said, they were founded to protect people that were along, that were going, moving along this route. So what this meant was, is that the Knights Templar were forced to send a few of the knights along with every pilgrimage. Now, this is, these are not crusades. These are just people that are walking from point A to point B because they want to go to Jerusalem by Good Friday so they can celebrate Easter in the Holy Land, right? Or whatever it might be. So this is a logistical nightmare. You've got to move the knights around. You've got to move the armies around with them, all the support that they need, all that kind of thing. Along with the lands that they were granted, and now with the relaxation of some of these rules with these new papal bulls, right? Over time, they began to buy land and they built castles and cathedrals, and they were free to use this wealth to erect the commanderies that they had all across Europe, to buy vessels, wagons, and all the supporting materials they would need to safely move a pilgrim from one commandery to the next commandery, right? So you might think of it as a series of bus or train stations that slowly but surely facilitated safe travel to the Holy Lands. Over time, this network of commanderies grew to over 1,000 bases of operation throughout Europe. Some of these got built in Venice, Italy. So the Templars in that area were able to observe and learn from the methods of the Venetian merchants. So they started using convoys of ships and provided their own security by including armed forces in those convoys. Wealthier crusaders and pilgrims wanted faster and more secure methods of travel to the Holy Land, and it became apparent to the Templars in that area that they should travel instead of walking by sea.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was faster, it could move more people, and it could serve more than one purpose. They were not only transporting pilgrims, right, which is what we think of, but they were also transporting new recruits and money that had been donated back to the Templars' headquarters in the Temple of Solomon. So then one of them, I guess some bright guy, eventually figured it out, but they eventually started issuing, quote, letters of credit for anyone wishing to journey to the Holy Land. And it worked like this. So if you wanted to go to the Holy Land, you know, you're going to need money, right? So what he would do is he would, quote unquote, deposit his wealth into one of the 1,000 commanderies. And then he's given a, quote, note, or what we would call today a deposit slip. And then when he gets to the Holy Land, he could then redeem his deposit slip for an equivalent amount of treasure, or by making what we would call today a withdrawal. This was in line with the goals of the order. They wanted to protect travelers who were on a pilgrimage. And by not carrying anything of value, it was believed that this would make them less attractive to potential robbery.
That's not a bad idea. I mean, why rob someone with no cash on hand? And who's going to steal these IOUs that they have? Because to cash it in, you're going to have to make this ungodly long pilgrimage yourself.
Right.
So,
and you got to show up to the knights and go, hey, I need this. And they're going to be like, how'd you get this? That's not your name.
Yeah. And once the pilgrims arrived at their destination, they'd still have all their moolah for food and lodging and souvenirs, man. And I'm sure that shit wasn't cheap.
No, it was not. I bet you. We do know that businesses sprang up all over the Holy Land to meet any conceivable demand a pilgrim might have. They charged top dollar for food and lodging.
Sure.
You know they did. And since the merchants never really knew when the next battle would take place, because keep in mind, crusades, they didn't know when the next one would happen. And so the Holy Land would be lost to pilgrims once again. So, you know, no customers, no money. In fact, this kind of happened regularly, which led to more crusades and more death and devastation and more riches for the Knights Templar. After the failure of the Fourth Crusade, King Richard the Lionheart, who you might have heard of, sold the entire island of Cyprus to the Knights. Now, Cyprus is about the same size as Puerto Rico. I mean, it's big. And this meant that the Knights Templar could collect taxes and tithes from the entire population. Well, and as they found out, of course, the downside to owning a country is the population expects things like, I don't know, governance from you, right? And the order had really little interest in this. They just wanted tithes and taxes and give me some money. And so they wind up selling it to the king of the country of Jerusalem, this guy who's living in the temple on the Temple Mount, right? Mm-hmm. For exactly the same amount of money that they paid for it. So it's a wash. But a little twisted. They kept some of the land and some of the castles that existed on the island. I mean, it was, after all, conveniently located for ports and a way to get supplies to the Levant countries, right? So over time, it becomes more and more valuable. And eventually, though, as things go, support for the Crusades in the Levant countries begins to wane. There are some minor Crusades that really didn't accomplish much. In 1291, the Kingdom of Jerusalem fell again, and that meant that the primary mission of the Knights Templar became less important. Support began to dwindle, and it really does get more complicated than just, you know, oh, well, why should we be doing that? Keep in mind, there were 1,000 commanderies around Europe. These had become vital elements in the day-to-day lives of people living in these areas. Only 10% of the order was focused on military activities. The other activities provided at the local level were depositories, safe transportation of people and goods, because you go from commandery to commandery. And if you happen to hook it all up and get to the Holy Land, great. But if you just wanted to go to the next town over, they did that too, like a greyhound, providing alms to the poor and security all around the lands for the commanderies was vital. These were vital services the order still provided. Now, remember, there was a papal bull that essentially said that the order only answered to the Pope, right? This was still in effect. It essentially meant that the order and its military, including all the knights and ground troops, which they still did have, were basically a kingdom of their own within established European kingdoms. They could pass freely through all kingdoms, and they owed no allegiance to any king. This did not sit well with the kings of the European kingdoms.
Yeah, just think about it. So you're the ruler of this country, and there's basically a foreign army in your country collecting taxes from lands that you don't own that are within the boundaries of your kingdom, and they're moving goods through your kingdom without paying tariffs to you. And basically they're doing whatever they want without you being able to do anything about it. It's like when your kids move back home as adults.
It really is. I mean, I can honestly see, you know, in hindsight, this is going to end badly, right? You know, because after a while, they're going to get sick of this shit. These guys have all this money and they got a standing army sitting in my country and they've got all these little forts all over the place. This is a problem. And oh, by the way, those things are banks essentially with wealth in them and I can't get my hands on it.
Yeah.
You know, how do I tax that when it's in the commandery? I can't even see it. How am I going to tax it? This was going to end badly, right? So the king of France at this time, a guy named Philip the Fourth, or sometimes Philip the Fair, because he thought he was hot shit and beautiful. But anyway, he had gone into massive debt to the Templars, believe it or not, because he borrowed a bunch of money, not only to fund his father's war against England, but also to fund some crusades. Because, you know, it was a popular thing to do and the populace was happy if you ran a crusade off. So he was in massive debt. He does eventually pay back the Templars, but then he gets the money to pay the Templars from Florentine bankers. Okay. And the Florentine bankers, well, you know, bankers, they started charging him really big interest, and he started missing payments, and the interest kept growing, and then they wanted to run his stuff. So eventually, you know, it goes all bad. Massive debt is not good. You know, it forces weird behaviors. But in this case, King Philip decides instead to tank his currency. He is going to cause massive inflation. And so he uses this massive inflation to repay his debt to them using much less valuable money. So at the time, they were using coins that were minted out of silver. So if a coin was silver and it had 100% silver in it, how do you inflate that? You put less and less silver in it. You start cutting it with lead. And this pissed off the Florentine bankers. It just pissed them off no end. Yeah, because, you know, the books say he paid them back. But they were all mad now. So inflation becomes so bad that eventually he needed to tax everyone in the country. Everyone. He taxed everyone at 50%. He seized half their lands, half their money, half their goods, all of it. And then he used a loan from the Pope. Again, we're back to borrowing money to settle a debt. But then he moves the French treasury, the entire French treasury, to a depository under the control of the Knights Templar. So we come back full circle, right? He's really...
Yeah, I thought he was pissed at the Knights Templar.
He is. And now he's back into debt to these guys. And he had to move it to their control because he didn't want anybody else seizing it from him. Now, he's pissed off. He's in debt. He doesn't know what to do. And he doesn't want to pay back the Templars or the Pope. And he doesn't really want a standing army in his country that wasn't his. And oh, by the way, it also has control of his treasury. So he decides he's had enough. And he brings charges against the Knights Templar, alleging they were heretical. And by bringing charges, I mean, he goes and he writes a letter to the Pope, and then they have a conclave, and he says, these guys are all a bunch of heretical people, and they don't deserve to exist. So here were the five charges levied by Philip against the Templars. They spit on the cross as part of their initiation. The initiate was stripped of his clothing and then kissed on the mouth, the belly button, and the posterior by the precept. The initiate was then told that, quote unquote, unnatural lust was normal and commonly practiced. The initiate wore a cord day and night that was consecrated by wrapping it around an idol. And that idol was adored in all the chapters. And lastly, the priests of the order, remember, they were able to found churches and cathedrals and have masses and stuff. So lastly, priests of the order did not consecrate the hosts in celebrating mass, but they pretended that they did so they could mislead the congregants. What a bunch of hooey. There's a bunch of historical church stuff, too, that's coming into play. I mean, essentially, the Pope at the time was Philip's second cousin, I think. And instead of living in Rome, this Pope lived in Brittany in France. Philip wants to establish a royal theocracy, one that would place him above the Pope. Because, again, you got to keep in mind, at this time, it was basically parallel structures, right? You had the secular king and you had the Pope, and they were kind of split. But he wanted to be number one above all the kings and also have the Pope report to him. But in order to pull this off, he needs to destroy the order of the Knights Templar. At daybreak, on the 13th of October, 1307, which was a Friday, hundreds of Templars in France were simultaneously arrested and then tortured into admitting that these five heresies were true. So did you know that this is where the notion that Friday the 13th is unlucky comes from?
I did actually know that.
So a side note, right? As historians, you know, we can look back at time and see what had gone on. But this is exactly the list of charges against the Knights Templar were almost identical to the charges levied against Pope Boniface VIII. Now, again, this was King Philip the Fair, or Philip IV of France, right? He levied these exact same charges against Pope Boniface. And Pope Boniface, before the charges were set, right, had begun an effort to raise the papacy above the royal families of Europe. Also, when King Philip tried taxing and seizing church lands, Pope Boniface had blocked those moves, and that had forced King Philip into even more debt, right? Because he thought he was going to tax the church altogether. This had angered King Philip IV enough that in 1303, he accuses Pope Boniface of these heresies. He uses this as a justification to, quote, arrest the Pope and put him in jail. And the Pope remained in jail for 3 days, and they eventually were forced to release him after he had a really bad beating. Now, who beat him? Who can say? Don't know. But after he got loose, there was an agreement that was reached that the King of France could not be excommunicated, and he held a special position as, quote, defender of Christ. Unwilling to let it all go, after Pope Boniface dies, he just whips out these charges again and has him tried by Pope Clement V, who is his cousin, posthumously. So they're trying a dead man in 1309. No verdict was ever rendered. And since it almost worked with Pope Benedict, King Philip, he just uses the same list, right? Issues the same charges. But in any case, through the application of torture, King Philip was able to get, quote, successful confessions of heresy from over 300 Templars he had arrested that day. And then he had them all burned at the stake. So then King Philip seizes all of the Templar property in France and loots it all.
That Peckerwood bastard. Or as they say in France, Bétard de Bois de Pecker. And yes, I know all of our French listener is saying, we don't say that. But this is part of the Templar history that I do know a little bit about. It didn't take long for word to get around that the Templars had, quote unquote, confessed to the heresies. And everyone was screaming that something had to be done to punish these iconoclasts. So the public, with the royal aid of King Philip, put enormous pressure on the Pope to do something already.
Yep.
And in 1307, Pope Clement, who was in Philip's pocket, issued a papal bull called Pastoralis Praemunicia, which ordered all kings in the kingdom to arrest all of the Templars and seize all of their properties. And then, after a series of forced confessions, trials, and executions were completed, the Knights Templar were no more. Kind of a witch hunt for the Templars.
Yep, it's true, but it's not entirely true. So in England, for instance, the king didn't believe any of this crap that spewed forth from King Philip's mouth, right? And he saw it for what it was, a cash grab. But he was compelled by this papal bull to arrest and try the Templars. So many were arrested and tried, but very few were executed. In Spain, the king simply moved all the Templars and their property to a different religious order, one called the Order of Montesa. And in Portugal, the Knights Templar simply changed their names to the Order of Christ. So at the time of this dissolution, check this out, there were over 15,000 Templar houses across Europe and Cyprus, an entire fleet of ships. And there were rumors in France that hundreds of the Templars had fled to Scotland in a fleet of 18 ships laden with knights, supplies, and treasures.
I believe that some claim that the Templars didn't stop in Scotland, but went across the Atlantic to land at Oak Island in Nova Scotia, Canada, which in turn eventually fueled the legend of the treasure that's believed to be buried there and gave birth to the History Channel series, The Curse of Oak Island.
Yeah, that's all pretty cool. It really is. But I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
I don't think the kind of ships that you use in the Mediterranean Sea are the same kind of ships you use for open oceans, you know? I think, I have no idea really. I'm not an expert or even a novice. I mean, I don't know jack shit about sailing or how ocean-going vessels are built. So anyone who knows more about this can feel free to correct me, but I don't think they had those kind of boats. I think they had the kind that were more for a sea and not for an ocean. But there is absolutely no doubt, it is a historical fact, that the Templars were in Scotland. They built their first commandery in Scotland in 1128 near a site called Temple Village in Midlothian, Scotland. And there are lots of other sites too. Jim, have you ever heard of Roslyn Chapel?
Isn't that mentioned in that Da Vinci Code book about, you know, all these holy mysteries and the Grail and Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene and their child having survived and the child is actually the Holy Grail because it's the Sangreal, which means holy blood or something like that.
Yeah, it depends on where you put the space, right?
Right, yeah.
In French.
Yeah.
So you have Sangreal, which would be Holy Grail. And then you have Sang, which is blood. Real, which is royal.
Yeah. So, yeah. So vaguely, I have some general superficial knowledge of that. But it is true, there's a Roslyn Chapel. And it's an interesting place to visit. It's full of carvings that are, you know, full of symbology. And the local lore does state that the Holy Grail was kept there. I believe the basis for this legend is that the knights were originally based in Jerusalem and they had access to the Holy Sepulchre and retrieved the Grail.
They found the Grail and found
something like that. Yeah.
Yep. This is all true. I mean, you know, I don't know about the married to Mary Magdalene stuff and all that kind of thing, but Dan Brown in that book, The Da Vinci Code, kind of popularized the idea. But in that scholarly, quote unquote, scholarly book that I told you about earlier, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, which was published in 1982. He's the guy that really linked the Roslyn Chapel with the Holy Grail stuff by looking at the carvings and trying to translate some of the language and all the symbology that was used in the carvings there at the temple. And so I mean, there's a little bit of basis for it too, but the knights are also, you know, they flee, right? So a lot of them died. In practice, though, it really looks like only 350 of the 150,000 or so members of the order, only about 350 were executed. 300 of them by King Philip by burning them at the stake. And then the rest of them all bugged out. They're like, fuck this, I'm out. And they leave, right? So they took all this stuff with them. Or did they? I mean, Philip claims to have looted all the commanderies. It's hard to move goods at this time, right? You can't move piles of gold or silver or whatever it might be. So it's hard to say where it all went, but that's part of the mystery, you know? That's part of the fun stuff when it comes to these things. Are you familiar at all with Freemasonry?
Again, superficially, I don't have any... Like my dad wasn't in it, my uncle wasn't in it, now Cynthia and Cynthia's family, they were into Masonry and Order Eastern Star and all that. Yeah.
So it depends on who you talk to, right? Freemasonry has the Scottish Rite. Have you ever heard it called that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this links them. They claim linkage back to the Knights Templar via this. That what really happened was the order went underground and they had tons of people that we sent. Like I said, they weren't all knights, right? They had masons. They had all these merchants and logistic expertise and all these other sorts of things going on. And that knowledge just simply didn't vanish. It was also believed that at this time, that was why they were heretical, was that because of their exposure to the Holy Sepulchre and being in Jerusalem, that they became sort of a Gnostic faith, which depended on not only the teachings of the church, but also a sort of a quote unquote hidden knowledge and spiritualism. And that tradition has supposedly carried on through into the Masonic order of today. And there are people that claim that that's the modern version of the Knights Templar. Now, I have no idea how you would link this or not, because nobody talks about what the Masons do, actually, right?
Right, right.
But that's another one of those things that they link to the Knights Templar. And then lastly, the Knights have always been traditionally linked with the Ark of the Covenant. So in a book called The Sign and the Seal in 1992, written by Graham Hancock, he claims that the Templars discovered the secrets of the Masons. Now, not the Masons like the organization, but the Masons being the guys that built the Temple of Solomon, right? He claims that the Knights Templar found this information and were able to use this information. They paired it with the records from Herod, King Herod, when he had rebuilt Temple Mount. Because what had happened is Temple Mount was at one point just a hill, right? And they built the temple on top of the hill. Erosion and stuff started falling all over the place, and they didn't want all the stuff on the top to come sliding down the hill because of erosion. So King Herod built the wall around it. He basically squared off the mount and backfilled it with dirt so that the wall, the hill didn't fall over. And that's part of that's what we call the Wailing Wall today. This is the wall that Herod built. But this guy, Graham Hancock, claims that when the Templars started doing all of this, because, I guess they stand around and have nothing else to do. I don't know. But they discover that in the wall the masonry information in at Temple Mount, that there are records that the Templars supposedly found that say that the Ark of the Covenant had been moved to Ethiopia. Now, that's a pretty cool idea.
Mm-hmm.
Graham Hancock guy, he claims that all this information is hidden in plain sight in carvings, engravings, and paintings of the time period, right? That's how they communicated things. And supposedly, there's in Ethiopia, there's a lot of Christians, and that goes back a long time as far as Christianity goes. But, we tend to think of Christianity as being Western Christianity. Like the Eastern Orthodox stuff is all kind of weird to us, and it's kind of, ooh, what is that? But these early churches were, they kind of fell under the Eastern Orthodox side of things. They claim to have the Ark to this day.
Yeah, they don't let anyone in. But yeah, they have, they claim it's inside that temple or church or what, I'm not sure what they call it, but yeah.
So there you have it, our little look at the Knights Templar, and why I really love them is because it's intriguing, to think about what would an army do with all this money and all this wealth. I mean, they had the entire treasury of France under their control.
And you don't even have to pay your soldiers.
Yeah, they all took vows of poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a recipe for money piling up, isn't it? And of course, over time, that's all people focus on is money, 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 money. I just think the whole thing's fascinating. Plus, knights in shining armor. What's not to like, right?
Right.
That's it, Jimmy. Any closing thoughts?
Nope. Just the end of an era. Or said another way, Knightfall for the Templars.
What Do You Think About is co-written by John Gordos and Jim Dumermuth. Our theme music, In Suspense, is provided by podsummit.com. Thanks to all of you, our listeners. Please take the time to rate the podcast on your favorite listening platform. Drop us a line at wdouta@gmail.com or visit our Facebook page, anchor.fm/wdouta, for updates on releases. Copyright 2022 by John Gordos and Jim DeMarco.
Hey, John, what eats more knights than a dragon?
I have no idea, Jim. What eats more knights than a dragon?
Two dragons.
Yes, indeed.